Among Books is a show where we talk about reading and more. It's recorded in person at Hilltop Books in Northwest Philadelphia. I'm Stephanie Marutis of Kuvenda Media, and on this episode, I chat with David Wu. He's an actor and serves as an elected board member for the Philadelphia local of the SAG-AFTRA Union. For more about David Wu, please check out the show notes, where you'll also find a reading list based on our conversation. David Wu, welcome to Among Books.
Well, thank you, Stephanie Marutis. It's good to see you again after all these years.
It is. In full disclosure, David and I first met way back at WHYY. We both work there.
Yeah, it was 20 years ago.
We were just reminiscing. A lot of great people there, and glad that we have that in common. And we have a Northwest Philadelphia connection in common. That's how I've run into you over the past years, which has been great. So what are you reading these days, David?
Well, mostly closed captions and subtitles. I mean, I've been reading that people have been, like, you're on a YouTube video or a Facebook video and you're doom scrolling and then you don't bother turning them off and they're just there. And it's like, hey, these match what they're saying. The spelling's way off, but it's kind of something else to engage your mind while you're also listening and watching. You can read along and kind of get an easier way to comprehend what's happening in terms of what the story is. So I've been reading a lot of those. Lately, it's mostly a nonfiction book is what I'm reading a lot of. I'm going back to de Tocqueville's, the translation of de Tocqueville's On Democracy.
Very pertinent.
And I've kind of plotted through that. And I'm thinking, how close is the English translation to his French and what he wrote? But the stories are kind of interesting in that I just remember a lot of pundits are, I don't think they're quoting him anymore, but they're quoting the Tocqueville's On Democracy, a lot of the political pundits when I was coming up. And I thought, I probably should read this book. And the parallels between essentially 200 years ago and now, we're the same people. We just have different technology than the folks back then had, but we're essentially the same people in terms of our communities. And that's what I get out of that book, is that your local community is a really important aspect of how your life kind of revolves around you and your neighbors.
Yeah, that has the most impact on you, your day-to-day.
My day-to-day. I kind of like think back to some of it. And I'm at the point now where it's like, I don't remember reading that. And I guess we all get older and you go back and you think about these books that you've read. And when you reread them, you get a different perspective because you're 10, 20, 30 years older. And that's the thing I think you don't get enough of as a kid. You get the book lists and, you know, you read a couple of the books and then you go on to the next assignment, whatever it might be. And there's not any thought about going back. And I think the one book, the most, probably the Bible is that people use that as a reference guide. And I maybe read passages and I've heard things quoted, but I've never read it cover to cover. But we probably should be doing a little more of that as people, going back to books we've loved and rereading them and kind of reengaging.
Yeah, I, from time to time, will do that. Similar to you, at different stages of my life, I read a book when I was 18 and I reread it now. And I thought, wow, similar reaction, but also I lived many more years in between, right?
Yeah.
And so you gain insights that you did not have when you were 18.
That's right. Depending upon our life experiences, we could be very different people than we were 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 years ago.
So it's interesting because we're the ones changing. The text does not change.
Yeah.
Going back to you saying you were reading a lot of subtitles and captions, since I've known you, you have become an actor. Tell us about that.
Yeah. After I left HYY, I went to another nonprofit and then I got laid off. I'm like, oh, well, what do I do? And resumes going out and nobody's hiring me. It's like, I'm sure a lot of people have that experience. And then there was this call out for background actors and I just went, well, let me go and do that. And it was for a movie. I ended up doing like 3 days on the movie and made a boatload of money because I had gotten what was called the Taft-Hartley waiver, where you're allowed to work the union contract without being in the union because you need to meet those numbers of what the union contract is. And I went, wow, this is pretty good. then I thought, wow, I just have to get like one of these a day.
We'll pay the bills.
Pay the bills. And unfortunately, those were busy overtime days. And not every day is an overtime day. And not every day is a busy day on set as a background actor. Mm. And then I was able to get myself an agent. I've gotten some print jobs. And I got one audition that I actually got the job for a speaking role. And it was a very simple line, and it was very easy to remember. And it's like, how do I motivate for this? And it's like, oh, I'll just say the line out straight. And that was all that was required for that.
And what was that line?
I now pronounce you man and wife.
Classic.
I was playing a wedding officiant. And it's the only job I'd ever gotten where I didn't get an upgrade on set, where I actually did the audition. And then they were like, well, you got the job. I was like, great. And then it hasn't happened since. That was several years ago. But recently, you were telling me that how you were able to kind of get back in touch when you saw
Tell us about the play you
were
in.
Well, I haven't been on a stage since high school. And I've been doing TV background work and commercial work for, I want to say, 15 years now. But it's actually been closer to 18.
Wow.
And every once in a while, I'll get what are called sides, and I'll get tagged or I get booked to be a stand-in, and I'm reading along with what the lines are. And we only typically get no more than 3, 4, 5, 6 pages of the entire script, because that's all we're shooting for the day.
Yes.
And then I'm in this play, and I'm going, is this 80 more pages?
The whole script.
The whole script. I did the audition, and I got it. It was a small little production in Camden.
It was called How the Light Gets
In. It was a play on a song. A Leonard Cohen song. Mm. And the writer was playing. It was a love story. And I got it and I went, oh, now what do I do? And it was very, like, I can read the thing. I read the thing and I can comprehend it eventually. And I read it several times. But to remember it, where for 15 years I'm not needing to do more than worry about a line or two at a time, was frightening. You know, just professionally, very like, oh, I'm an imposter. They're going to know I can't do this.
Oh, yes, you can. And you did do it.
I did do it. Oh. It took a couple hours a day of rehearsal for about 6 weeks.
Wow. First of all, congratulations on doing that and being brave and going out for a stage production.
I didn't go looking for it. A friend of mine, they were looking for a particular Asian type. Yeah. And he was going to be out of the country, so he couldn't do it. So he gave them my name. And then I went, oh, well, it's another audition. Let's go for it, because I've done tons of these and never gotten the job. So let's not worry about memorizing anything yet.
You're like, no, I am going to have to memorize.
And then it's like, oh, well, I think it was okay, the audition. And I met all the folks, the directors and the folks at the company. And it was a really good group of people. And we did the thing. And the other three people in the play, you know, they had already been on that particular stage a couple of times each. And I'm thinking, I was a mass communications major. And I did some theater stuff in high school, okay. And that was it. And I'm thinking, I can't keep up with them. And it took me a while to kind of finally get professionally comfortable enough to do what I needed to get done.
Well, walk us through that process. How did you do it? What was your approach to learning your role? And what was your role?
Well, it was a Japanese architect who was supposed to design this Japanese tea house in a Japanese garden. And then the protagonist of the show was a woman who was single. He was a widower. And they kind of meet. And the story revolves around that particular design process. And then her lack of a support circle that's immediately there. And then her cancer diagnosis. Mm. It was a breast cancer story. And I went, this is pretty deep. This is pretty heavy. It's like, I hope they do at least a trigger warning at the beginning, because it's pretty serious. And she really did a wonderful job in terms of bringing out all that emotion. Because we all know, I mean, everybody in this country knows somebody. They know somebody that's had cancer of one sort or another. Mm. So that really hit home. Mm. And it's a whole interesting story. But because it was a small production, we did get paid not very much.
It's different than making commercials.
Yeah. And one of the lines was, this Japanese architect was so far removed because of his wife's death that he's designing these very cold projects. And then he's supposed to be a celebrity architect. And then he takes his little dinky job for this little small Japanese garden for a little dinky tea house. And one of his lines was, and I took this job, I have to remember, for a most humble amount of money.
Mm.
And then one time when we were in one of the dress rehearsals, I looked right at the director and I said that. And he was like, yes, yes. And I learned a lot about this. And one of the things was, we are essentially living real lives under imaginary circumstances. And for me, that was very real. And that motivation was very real. And it came across. And it was kind of like breaking the fourth wall at that point.
So this character resonated with you. And how did you learn your lines? You were saying you would look at the script, I'd read it.
I'd repeat it. And then when we were together for rehearsals, we'd read with each other and we'd run the lines. And that's what it takes. Is for me, it takes that kind of rote repetition. And then when you learn the lines and then it becomes part of you, and then you try to embody that particular character, and it's different for every actor. This particular director was a disciple of the Meisner technique, where you're not, it's, I haven't studied it enough.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard it. He basically states it is that you're living realistically under imaginary circumstances.
Hmm.
And you're trying to make it as real as possible on that stage. You know, who am I? I mean, I've done one line on a TV show. I've done no lines in any of the commercials that I've done. And I've done no lines as a background actor and dozens of lines in this play. So I've got very little experience compared to a bunch of my peers out there who are doing this pretty regularly.
I'm amazed. I mean, good for you. I mean, that is an undertaking.
Yes, it was.
You know.
I'm glad I did it. It was a wonderful experience. Yeah. There are some great professional folks out there doing this in these small theaters all over the country.
Yeah, and that was the South Camden Theater Company.
Yes, in South Camden.
Okay, yeah. How the Light Gets In. Well, you mentioned earlier that, you know, you hadn't been on stage since you had been in high school. Tell us about where you grew up.
Well, I grew up in New York City.
Which part?
The Lower East Side. And I was born in Hong Kong. My parents came over as refugees from the Communist Chinese in the 60s. I wasn't even a year old.
Okay, you were very small.
I was very, yeah. My grandfather had been in the States since the war. He'd been in the Merchant Marine.
I see.
He was doing the North Atlantic convoys.
Wow.
And he had like one or two ships sunk from under him.
Oh, wow.
But he had gotten his citizenship. Mm. And then he was able to get his son, my father, and his wife, and my grandmother, and get them over here. And then we grew up on the Lower East Side.
So what was your household like growing up? What was the language in the house?
We spoke Mandarin at home, a little bilingual, and then in school it was English.
Yeah.
So I remember growing up as a kid, a lot of people would be saying that I didn't have an accent. And then I don't even have a New York accent from what people tell me. The interesting thing about that is I gotten a lot of that where people would see me and then I would say something.
Mm-hmm.
And most people who would see me and say something were white people who didn't know, had no experience of an Asian individual who spoke accentless, non-regional American English.
Mm.
When I got older, I served in the Army, went through ROTC at the University of Vermont.
Mm.
And one time, I'm on active duty, I'm doing something, talking to people on the phone for whatever I was doing, and we're on base. They know I'm in the Army. And then when I go and meet these people, typically what shocked me was the first thing out of the mouth was, wow, you speak very good English. At the time, I was in my 20s. I didn't know how to react to that. I said, well, okay, well, so do you. Thank you. But then I'm thinking, wait a minute.
Yeah.
You know my name. We've spoken on the phone maybe 4, 5, 6 times for whatever this was. And you finally meet me. And then you're like befuddled that I'm this guy, David, who that you've spoken to. It was just kind of fascinating. So now I'm a little less surprised by that when it happens. And it happens much less rarely.
So you did ROTC during college, then you spent 3 years in active duty. Were you a reader during that time?
Yes, reading manuals, field manuals.
Okay, tell us about that.
On operations. Veterans will know. The U.S. government has a way of cataloging things. And there's a manual for just about every piece of equipment had a user manual, had a depot level repair manual. And then operationally, there were all sorts of processes and standard operating procedures that we had manuals for, you know, for the attack, for the defense, for this equipment. And we had to read all of this. Mostly, we didn't have a lot of time to read all of it. So it's a lot of skimming and it's a lot of referencing. It's like going to this. So let's say there's a mechanic who's responsible for repairing all the vehicles. They would have had a manual for every piece of equipment. And then I would have to, if I was a motor officer, I don't think I ever was a motor officer. Mm-hmm. It was so long ago. I would have had to have had an understanding of each of them to find where you needed to find what you needed to know. And that was the most important part about reading in the military, is you needed to know where to find the information you needed. And if you didn't know where to find it, you had to ask someone who knew. And I remember at the time I was in the infantry, I was a second lieutenant. I remember reading a whole series of pulp paperbacks, you know, the Brotherhood of War. And it was all these stories of these military people. And then Tom Clancy's novels, spy novels. And that was what I was reading lot, because that's the kind of stuff I thought I was involved in or I wanted to be or in my mind I wanted to be a part of. But in reality, it wasn't like that.
No.
Well, for me, it wasn't. There's some people out there who do some really secret stuff.
Yes.
But for the rest of us who are just regular soldiers who are, you know, I was commissioned as a reserve officer, but I did 3 years on active duty and then I stayed in the reserve to fill a 20-year commitment.
Well, thank you for your service.
Well, it was something that I felt I wanted to do and I needed to do. Part of it was just to kind of, I don't know, get back at those people who would say, oh, you speak very good English, with the intention of letting me know that I might not be a full citizen of this country.
Feels eerily on point in 2025.
Well, that kind of thinking and that kind of attitude hasn't left us.
No, it hasn't. We're going to take a short break now from our conversation and turn it over to Amy Wilson. She's the executive director of the Friends of the Chestnut Hill Library and manager at Hilltop Books, where we record the show.
We're a used bookstore run on book donations, so it's volunteer staffed, open 6 days a week, and it's run by the Friends of the Chestnut Hill Library. All of the books in the store are just a third of the retail price on the book. Proceeds from our sales benefit the Chestnut Hill Library. So we support programs at the library, we support the book collections, and we also help out with building maintenance and advocate for the library system as a whole. We love volunteers. There's a range of volunteer opportunities, from working in the store to helping us with pop-ups and special events, and our volunteer intake form is on our website.
For more about Hilltop's hours, location, and volunteer opportunities, log on to hilltopbooks.org. And come join us at the bookstore for a party to celebrate Among Books on Saturday, October 11th from 3 to 5 p.m. Get a chance to chat with some of the people featured on the podcast, including Pennsylvania State Senator Art Haywood. Refreshments and light snacks will be served. And if you like walking and hearing scary stories, don't miss a very special ghost walk with Hilltop Books on Saturday, October 18th. Live storytellers will be sharing tales along a short route from the Chestnut Hill Library to the bookstore. For more details and to sign up, log on to hilltopbooks.org and click on events. Now, back to our conversation. So let's talk about your interest in community, because just going back to, you know, you mentioned rereading the Tocqueville's On Democracy and sort of how community, that has the most impact on a day-to-day.
Yeah.
And you served on the board of Weaver's Way,
yeah,
Cooperative Association, which has now 4 supermarkets.
Yeah.
Tell us how you got involved, why you got involved.
Well, this goes back to my upbringing in New York. We didn't live in the co-ops, but there were cooperative housing nearby. and they had a strip mall or a strip section of stores, and one of them was a food co-op.
Okay.
Twin Pines, which was kind of the co-op-y logo. But I just remembered, I think my grandparents and my parents would go through receipts for the patronage dividend. That's how they tracked those back then. It's like, you would get a patronage dividend if you turned up with your receipts. Mm. And that's how they would figure out what your patronage dividend was back then.
Wow.
Because this would have been in the 60s and the 70s. And I remember the co-op. And jumping ahead a little bit, a Pathmark opened up in the neighborhood, and that was the end of the co-op. Mm. They weren't savvy enough to figure out how to do the marketing to keep people coming. Mm. And New York is, no matter what's there, it's still price-oriented for a lot of folks there. So I remembered that experience. And then in college at the University of Vermont, I saw a thing for REI, mm-hmm. a co-op. And I got a lot of my co-op education there because one of the first catalogs had a story about the Rochdale Pioneers from 1844 who wrote everything down and essentially had the first successful cooperative that endured. And I learned a lot about that. And then I moved here to Philadelphia and someone said, oh, there's a food co-op, Weaver's Way, and I joined. And I had taken all this knowledge where I didn't really understand or care about co-ops. Mm. And here I am, I guess it would have been 27, 28, 29 when I moved here. Mm. So I've been a member for many years. Mm-hmm. And then I moved around, left the co-op, came back. I like Northwest Philadelphia, mm-hmm. moved back into it. It's very diverse and a lot of mm-hmm. different people here and there are a lot of different aspects of community. Mm-hmm. And I've always enjoyed that. Mm-hmm. And then we had this financial debacle that if you Google Weaver's Way, mm-hmm. financial scandal, that'll get you educated on mm-hmm. it. So that caused the whole cooperative to basically we almost lost the business.
I did not know this story.
Yeah. And I saw an emergency meeting and we had the biggest meeting that I'd ever been to.
Wow.
Like 300 people showed up. It was a debacle. Mm. And then I got up there and I said, hey, you come up here. We just elected these people on the board of directors. Mm-hmm. You want heads to roll? Put your head on the chopping block. Mm-hmm. And then, I don't know, an 80-year-old woman threatened me to run for the seat on the board of directors.
She challenged you.
Yes.
Okay.
She said, I'm going to hit you, David, if you don't.
She agitated you. Okay.
Yes. And then a couple other people were like recruiting me on to join the board. And I'd been on the membership committee for a while,
yeah.
meaning I had a little bit of experience with that. And I'd never wanted to ever be on a board of directors. I'd worked for nonprofits for many years. Mm-hmm. And I'd always thought boards, they're just people who write checks and they don't really know what's going mm-hmm. on until I was elected to this board. And I learned a heck of a lot about organizations and community. And I've learned a lot since the first stint of doing that. And there are a lot of dedicated people who want food co-ops to stick around because we're community, we're capitalism. And the thing about economics and political power that cooperatives and cooperative enterprise are for me an opportunity to bring ownership power, revenue generating power, down to the average person. Mm-hmm. Like at Weaver's Way, yes, there are people making lots of money, the companies that we have to buy from. But there are also 200 and 300 local vendors that are making local products,
yeah.
that are growing local products yeah. that we're selling, that we are benefiting. When I first joined in, I guess it would be 1990, we were probably a couple million in annual revenue. And that financial debacle mm-hmm. got me to thinking. We were pretty insular, in my opinion, mm-hmm. at the time. Mm-hmm. I was pretty happy. A lot of people were complaining that it seemed like a country club in terms of entitlement and elitism that was being, that they perceived coming out of the co-op. And there's probably a little bit of that, or they saw enough of it that they were turned off by it. Mm. And that stuck with me. And I thought, we need to expand this model. Mm. We need to get more people involved. Mm-hmm. We need to get more people operating under this umbrella.
When were you elected to the board?
I want to say 2000, and it was a few years after the initial breaking of that financial debacle.
Okay. Did you start to read about cooperative principles?
I did.
Like, what did you get in? Take us into the weeds, you know. Oh, what were you reading?
So the International Cooperative Alliance is kind of like an overarching umbrella. And then here in the States, we have the Cooperative League of the United States, National Cooperative Business Alliance or Association. It's the NCBA CLUSA. And they're kind of like the national overarching organization that kind of champions cooperative enterprise. So I started reading about them on the internet. And the thing that struck me before that was a book, Boards That Make a Difference, by John Carver. And he's a consultant, and he's not cooperatively focused. He's just organizationally focused in terms of nonprofit boards, corporate boards, community boards, any sorts of board-oriented governance. He calls this thing policy governance. And I read the book. I think I gave my copy of that book to somebody. I got to find another copy. But it's essentially a how-to get boards of directors. And for nonprofits and food co-ops, you know, mostly volunteers, unlike a corporate board where you're paid a stipend to attend the meetings. And the goal with this particular book is to get people expert in policy governance, where you're not micromanaging the executive director or the management. You're figuring out what's the strategic goal of this organization? What targets do we have? What objectives do we have? And how do we get there? Mm-hmm. And I read the policy governance documents that the co-op had developed from that book. I read the International Cooperative Alliance Principles of Cooperation. I've read and continue to reread The Ends of Weaver's Way, which are based on the policy governance documents on how we should be operating. And I've learned a heck of a lot in terms of organizational effectiveness, in that you're on the board not to champion a caucus or a demographic. You're there to champion the whole of the entire organization. And that's a tough thing to do, because in every organization, you got, I'm not a meat eater, I'm a vegan. I will not shop at a place that has meat, sort of thing.
Yeah.
And then you've got the people who are like, we need meat or we need raw milk. And then there are differences in preferences, differences in philosophy, differences in demands that happen. And being able to have a good balance of where all those competing interests are and trying our best to harmonize that and walk a tightrope through that has been an important aspect of what I think Weaver's Way has done well, not just me as an individual or a contributing member on the board, but the board as a whole and the community as a whole and the membership as a whole, because we're not just a store for just members. We're a store for everybody.
Again, we're coming back to your impulse to be involved at the community level. So you were heavily involved in Weaver's Way. You're still a member. You still keep up on it. As we heard, you became an actor and you are an elected board member to the Philadelphia local of the SAG-AFTRA. Some might say you're crazy to get involved again in another board, but clearly you have a desire or impulse to be involved at the community level. Tell us about that.
Sometimes I just can't say no. So my grandfather was a member of the National Maritime Union. He was a sailor. And I remember him taking me, I guess the office was in Greenwich Village where the union office was. And his English was never that good. But he spoke Spanish, too, because he was after the war, he worked on ocean liners. And at the time, ocean liners were like ocean liners, where people were going to places and they weren't like vacation hotels. So he stopped off in South America a lot and picked up a lot of Spanish, which was kind of fascinating. But he was a union guy. And when I left the Army, I was working part-time for a little bit at Macy's at the Metropolitan Museum of Art gift shop portion, up on the little balcony on the Herald Square store, and that was unionized. And then I got the Taft-Hartley waiver for the 3 days I worked as a background actor. And then I got the letter, and I said, well, you know, eventually I did join.
So how long have you been a board director?
Oh, gosh. I think it's only been 2 terms.
What have you had to read now for SAG-AFTRA?
The collective bargaining agreement.
There you go.
So that I at least know what's been bargained for. I haven't been on any of the negotiating committees. I know a couple of people that have been in terms of negotiating with the production companies. And I mean, that for me, the level of solidarity in this union was brought home to me during our strike. And seeing people from all the AFL-CIO affiliated unions coming in on the special events where we had Teamsters driving past. We had truck drivers, flight attendants, teachers, custodians. All of us were there. In a way, you know, in addition to unionism and cooperativism, like I was doing a little bit of reading in the 1800s and the 19th century, unions and cooperatives were like hand in hand.
I see.
And somehow along the way, they split apart. And then there's a group of people trying to bring some of that together, back together again.
I wanted to ask you, when you were growing up, what was reading like in your home?
My parents read the Chinese newspapers, and they read Chinese magazines. And I read English school books, and my dad read Chinese and English newspapers. He was a big Daily News reader. He'd never get the Times.
Okay.
It'd always be the Daily News.
Yeah.
And he occasionally would get the Post, because I think the tabloids were just easier to manage. But he never got the New York Times.
Yeah.
But the Chinese newspapers were folded the same way as in New York, in the broadsheets that the Times was. So he read those, but they weren't nearly as many pages. And then the printing on the Times, it's, you know, that type font is just so tiny for him.
It's very small.
And then I read, there was like a little kiddie encyclopedia that my parents had gotten.
Yeah.
I read that a lot. We got talked into buying the Encyclopedia Britannica.
Yes. This is, given everybody I'm talking to for this series, there's a lot of encyclopedia references.
Yeah. And I do remember reading this kiddie encyclopedia. I forgot the title of it, but now that I think about it, there are some entries in there that were about Robert E. Lee.
Oh.
And I realize now they were soft pieces on him. And it gave me a more positive impression of Robert E. Lee when I was a little kid looking at this encyclopedia. It didn't mention very much about his war effort. It didn't mention very much about his slaveholding antics. Did mention his, you know, after-war accomplishments and how he was, you know, very gentlemanly-like. And, you know, there was a level of chivalry that I got out of that. And I had that impression of him for the longest time. And until I realized his statue needed to be removed, those memories come back of reading those passages. I'm thinking, aw. And they go, no, his statue has to be removed. It cannot stand.
So here you had this instance where you had read something as a child and it had a slant.
Yes.
And then as an adult, reckoning with that.
Yes.
And being in the world and seeing that tension. And
how easy it is for textbooks to be manipulated, but to also realize that if we're taught enough in school, then we can come to the realization that we were misled.
Well, you have your ability to read and to make sense and meaning in the world and question, right? And able to hold multiple perspectives at once.
Well, we worked at A12, right? It's like lifelong learning, that public broadcasting motto. Lifelong learning. It doesn't stop.
Well, on that note of lifelong learning, we should maybe call this the lifelong learning question. But, you know, the big question on this podcast, when we get to the end of our conversations, are which books have had an impact on you, David? You know, what are the books that have influenced you, either how you think about the world, act in the world, live in the world? What might some of those books be?
De Tocqueville's On Democracy. Yes, that one. John Carver's, for me as a board director, John Carver's Effective Boards. He's got a series of books on that, but that was the first one that I've read that really gave me a good inkling of what that was. There was a book I was reading, like being a background actor, it's sometimes kind of boring because you're waiting to be used on set. Uta Hagen.
Uta Hagen.
An acting teacher. On acting. Was it on acting? Now I can't remember the title. I want to say it's on acting.
We'll figure it out in the show notes. you were reading that for approach and...
Yeah, just to kind of... Well, I'm doing this work as a background actor. I don't have any lines. I just have to make sure that I don't trip when I'm supposed to be moving. You know, one thing I have learned as a background actor is I've really learned how to move for camera. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You have to walk a little bit differently.
Yeah, and be aware of where the camera is.
Yes, and not look at it.
Yeah.
Not look at it. Because then that is so obvious. So it always freaks me out when a director pulls me for something and they go, I want you to look at the camera. And it's like all this experience and training all these years. Yeah. And it's like, that is so hard to do now because we're taught not to look at, it's not there. It's not there. Oh, there was something else that I, The New Jim Crow. That's a book that I'd been reading when I was working as a part-time tour guide at the Eastern State Penitentiary Historic Site. And I haven't finished it yet, but I picked up a copy and I have it somewhere. And it tells me that there's some bad influences out there in terms of what people want for this country. And it's not necessarily, I wouldn't call it a conspiracy, but a level of pushing for a particular narrative that is against diversity and is purely a white supremacist point of view, to the exclusion of everybody else that's here in this country. And that, for me, was an eye-opener that I thought that there was this kind of this amoglous, you know, you can't put your finger on it. That helped me put my finger on it in terms of how much work we have, in terms of the generational struggle to get things right, to give everybody a chance to live up to the promise, the American promise of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
David, I want to thank you for joining us on Among Books.
You're very welcome, Stephanie. And thank you so much for the invitation. This has been an honor and a pleasure to be a part of this.
Yeah, it's been great talking with you.
Among Books is mixed by Brad Linder and produced by me, Stephanie Marutis of Kuvenda Media. And a final special thanks to the Friends of the Chestnut Hill Library, its executive director and Hilltop Books manager, Amy Wilson, and the many volunteers who make the day-to-day operation of the bookstore possible. Until next time, happy reading.